My name is Owen, I work for Park End Church in Cardiff, and this is a video on making a biblical case for female elders and deacons. I do hope you appreciate the spirit of which I'm going to approach this topic and the desire to lift the Bible up to its highest place. I'll be using my own notes, I'll be referencing Wayne Grudem, who's very much on the complementarian side of the fence. I'll be drawing a lot from a book called Women and Authority by a man called Ian Paul. That booklet's online. You can buy it. And another popular author on this topic is Terran Williams. I'll be using terms like elder and deacon rather than priest or bishop. What English words best express the Greek is sort of for another video, though it does kind of overlap. But I'm going with elder and deacon mainly in this video because I'm in a denomination that uses those terms. But apply the terms as you will. This video is about women in positions of authority, ultimately. I'll be looking at some of the key texts in the Bible linked to this debate, and I'll put timestamps down below so you can fast forward to a particular Bible verse you might want to think through. If there's time at the end, we'll do a little Q&A, maybe it'll be a separate video, answering questions like, if this is the biblical position and women should be elders and deacons, then why hasn't it featured much in church history, at least in modern times? Isn't that an indicator that they shouldn't be in positions of authority? So we'll look at little things like that. Lots to cover, so let's jump in. The first key text I want to look, though some people will be annoyed already because I've skipped Genesis, but I will be referring to Genesis a bit later on, is Luke chapter 24, 1-11, particularly this account here in verse 11. So what's happened is Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, went to tell the 11 disciples that the tomb was empty. And there's this phrase here in verse 11, you can see, they did not believe the women because their words seemed to them like nonsense. There's also John chapter 20 where Mary Magdalene went to the disciples and shared the news and said, I have seen the Lord. And she told them that he had spoken to her. I don't tend to use this passage to show that women should be in positions of authority, teaching authority in church life, because the structures of church in the epistles are possibly different to these narrative accounts here. In fact, I think a few months ago, Rick Warren tried to use this passage to justify women elders and deacons or preachers or something, and he got absolutely trounced just on like an exegetical level. I'm just jumping here quickly to show that women were entrusted with spreading the resurrection account to the apostles, and it was discarded by them, and Luke is either trying to show us that women's testimony at the time was laughable in that culture, which if he is doing that, that may explain why in the Acts of the Apostles, men and their missions feature so heavily rather than what the women were doing. So it may not be a theological reason why Acts is mainly about the men's Bible teaching, but maybe because the culture wouldn't have been interested in what the women were doing. It might be that. But I actually think it's here to highlight the stupidity of the disciples, of the apostles, who didn't believe them. It's more likely a rebuke to unbelieving men. Of course, you've had doubting Thomas, so the slowness of heart to believe from the men is a recurring theme. And Luke is doing something quite countercultural. Whenever he gives a lady's account of teaching or sharing the gospel, it's in a positive light, which would have been radically different to the culture at the time, if indeed women's testimony wasn't accepted. We come now to Acts chapter 18, 18 to 21. It's there on the screen. And Priscilla and Aquila. So they are Paul's partners in ministry. They arrived in Corinth, probably following persecution in Rome. They founded a church in Ephesus. And when Paul returns there, it's up and running. And together, they are responsible for teaching Apollos, who was a Jewish believer from Alexandria. If we just turn the page there to verse 26, there's this phrase, he began to speak boldly in the synagogue. When Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they invited him to their home and explained to him the way of God more adequately. Other versions might say more accurately. In 1 Corinthians 16, verse 19, you will read that they basically have a church in their house. They seem to eventually return to their native city, and when Paul writes to the Roman church, here it is, this phrase here, greet Priscilla and Aquila, my fellow workers in Christ Jesus. So he actually calls them by then his fellow workers. And the word in Greek there is synagoi or synagi. And what that word does is it groups Priscilla and Aquila together as equal partners in the church work then. And when you tie that with the previous statement that she teaches sometimes, you don't get the immediate idea that she's just making teas and coffees or running the Sunday school. The point here is this. Paul appears not to be embarrassed to portray a woman as an equal partner with a man in engaging with the Jewish community, starting a church, being part of the leadership of it, and correcting the teaching of someone who would go on to be a prominent figure in the church. Sticking with Romans 16 that we just touched briefly on with Priscilla and Aquila, here Paul greets 27 people, 10 of them are women, and there are some things worth noting. Four of the women are said to have worked hard, either in the Lord or among you. The Greek word that the English translates working hard is kopiao, which Paul uses for himself and his own evangelism and church building. You'll see that in 1 Corinthians 15:10, Galatians 4:11, Philippians 2:16. Grateful for Ian Paul for those extra references. It also has connotations of ministry in 1 Corinthians 16:16 and 1 Thessalonians 5:12. As mentioned earlier, Priscilla and Aquila are called the fellow workers. That Greek word, that would be synergos or synergi again. Paul uses that elsewhere for some really key figures in positions of authority in the church, such as Timothy, Titus, Mark, Luke, and Philemon, and it's used for Priscilla as much as Aquila. Next thing to note is that Phoebe is called a deacon. Basically, the complementarian understanding of this term is that she was a servant of the church in a specific task. But others, even on that side of the fence, would say that she was a deaconess, but then define what the role of deaconess is very carefully so that it wouldn't involve like a teaching authority over men. I'm not persuaded that there's a reason to not consider it in its fullest sense, the word, that Phoebe was a deacon or a deaconess. There's no strong reason not to think that it's not the same role as mentioned in Philippians 1:1 or 1 Timothy 3, which would be the type of deacon role that men would have. She's also described as a prostatis, which has strong connections to the terms to do with leadership. You can read more about that in Romans 12, verse 8. In Romans 12, 8, the word proistamenos, forgive the pronunciation, is used. Here it is. This translates it leader or lead. Most translations would do that. Some people would say that that word prostatis means benefactor or patron. But when it's closely linked to this Greek word here, which it is, the word leader is the more natural English word to choose ahead of benefactor or patron. Also, it's worth noting that the New Testament uses another word for benefactor in Luke 22:25. Coming back to chapter 16, I'll just turn the page to verse 7. Junia. She is described here as outstanding among the apostles. The NIV isn't the best English version by a long shot. Other versions use the term prominent among the apostles. Some commentaries will say that this means prominent in the eyes of, so well esteemed in the eyes of. They would say that she's not part of the group of the apostles, but they're well liked. But particularly Ian Paul, who's done work on this word, really comes down on the side. He says it's certain that the phrase means that they are outstanding members of the group known as apostles. Some say that it's actually a man called Junius, but all the church fathers and the commentators up to the Middle Ages read it as a feminine word. There's a lengthy book on this topic by Eldon J. Epp, and he concludes the most natural way of reading this verse in the Greek is Junia, a woman and an apostle of some standing. So in the booklet I've got here, it quotes R.T. France, who sums up a lot of work on Romans chapter 16 as follows. The impression you get is that the Apostle Paul numbered women amongst his closest fellow workers in his apostolic mission, and that they held positions of recognized authority in his churches, and that they were engaged in teaching and indeed apostleship. Long story short, when you get to the Timothy passages, do remember these ones as well. 1 Corinthians 11, 2-16. Just looking there at verse 3, I want you to realize that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of every woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. This one comes up a lot in this topic of women's authority in the life of the church. What if there's men there? What if it's a mixed group? Can they teach? Should they just teach women? A lot of the discussion circles around what Paul means by the use of this word head, kephale, in Greek. And the traditional reading has understood head here to mean in a position of authority over. However, there's been a wave of commentators recently who are arguing that the meaning means source or origin, as in the head of a river. If you're an English speaker, you'll probably think head means authority. It's ingrained in us. I'm not sure that was always the thought process of the Greeks. I love the Greek Old Testament, the Septuagint, and that's not how the word is used there. And that was the Bible that Paul would have read. Now, Ian Paul, who's done work on the Hebrew, the word rosh for head is used figuratively as leader 171 times, but the Septuagint only uses kephale to translate this 6 times. For the other 165 occurrences, the Septuagint uses a non-figurative term for leader, and it uses kephale 226 times to mean the part of a body. In other words, in the Greek thought, kephale is not the usual term for head when it's used as having authority over, for which there are other terms. It's most commonly used literally to refer to this part of the body. Now, Wayne Grudem loves this point, and he tries to show that kephale in wider Greek literature did mean authority, and he considers 2,336 examples. And it seems to me that Ian Paul has really studied Grudem's examples and quite closely scrutinized his work and says that his examples don't support that argument. And he says, quote, "In fact, the use of kephale as a metaphor for leader first arises in those very few instances in the LXX, or the Septuagint. So this use is in fact influenced by the Hebrew metaphor rather than by normal Greek usage." If we read Ephesians 4, 15-16 and Colossians 2, 19, the word kephale signifies origin or source in Paul's writings. Christ is seen as the source of growth and maturity. In Ephesians 1, 22 and Colossians 2, 10, Christ is called head over all things in most English translations. But the Greek doesn't actually mean that, since the word translated over everywhere else in the New Testament is translated more than or beyond. To express rule or authority over something, the Greek uses another word, epi. And you can look up Luke 19, verse 14 and 27. "We will not let this man rule over us." This list in 1 Corinthians 11:3, woman, man, Christ, God, can work if it relates to authority, but if kefale is understood as origin, it works like this. Man had his origin in Christ's work of creation. The woman had her origin in the man. That's the Genesis passage. Christ had his origin in the incarnation from the Godhead. One of the books I've got here says it's interesting to note that whereas Paul emphasizes the creation origin of woman with man in verse 8, he specifically goes on to emphasize the mutuality of origin in verse 12. So Thistleton, a commentator, believes that deciding the meaning of this word on lexical grounds alone isn't tenable, and he concludes that in the light of Paul's use in the passage, kephale does not indicate a relation of subordination or authority over. And of course that makes sense because the purpose of the whole passage is for women to be enabled to freely pray and prophesy without bringing the community into disrepute. And that was a foundational part of the ministry. You can read that in 1 Corinthians 12:28. Ian Paul notes, interestingly, by the way, in Roman law, women had freedom to hold political and religious office, though generally in the Hellenistic world, women were seen as their husband's property and expected to conform to social conventions. Some pious Jews prayed, "I thank you, God, that you did not make me a woman." In this context, Paul's arguing for women's full participation in the worshipping assembly was radically emancipatory. 1 Corinthians 14:34 to 35, women should remain silent in the churches. They are not allowed to speak, but must be in submission, as the law says. If they want to inquire about something, they should ask their own husbands at home, for it is disgraceful for a woman to speak in the church. Tricky verses because Paul has previously said in 1 Corinthians 5, every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. It is the same as having her head shaved. So he seems to be contradicting himself here on one level, also with what he says in 1 Corinthians 12 and what he says here in the passages in front of you in the preceding verses. If women are to be silent and not to speak, how can they pray and prophesy in the assembly or be part of the all in chapter 14, verse 31 here? For you can all prophesy. So it's clear that these verses refer to some kind of speaking other than prophesying, or Paul's just flatly contradicted himself. Most scholars just simply sum it up like this, that it was a certain type of talking that they were forbidden to do, namely passing judgment on other people's prophecies. I think it's Wayne Grudem that agrees here that silence can't apply to all areas because that would rapidly lead to ludicrousy. They would not be allowed to sing, pray, look after the children, ask a friend how she was. The verb here for speaking could be understood as chattering. So were people being run down and embarrassed in the church there, and that type of talk needed to stop? Another understanding here is that in the first century context, it would have been a matter of shame for a man to be publicly criticized by a woman, especially by his wife. So Paul is saying, don't do that. In any case, it cannot mean that women should say nothing in the assembly or that any of the gifts of speech that the Spirit gives to all without gender differentiation in chapter 12 are forbidden to women, without making Paul directly contradict himself within a few verses. Ephesians 5, particularly there, verse 22, wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands as you do to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, his body of which he is the Saviour. As church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives. The most reliable manuscripts have no verb in verse 22. The idea of wives submitting to their own husbands must be inferred from the general command for all to be in submission to one another. The paragraph break in the English Bibles here isn't particularly helpful, because from 18 to 24, it's one single sentence starting with the command to be filled with the Spirit. One of my books here says the word for their own, idioi, is emphatic. This is not a general command for all women in relation to all men, but appears to emphasize that the mutual submission of all to one another does not obliterate structures of relations within marriage and the family. This passage is called the Household Code by some, and needs to be also contrasted with similar passages Paul writes. Paul uses a distinct word, hypotasso, for the relations of women to men. It's the same word he uses for all Christians in their humble submission to one another. Paul reserves the word for obey, hupakuo, for the relations of children to parents and slaves to their masters, in chapter 6, verses 1 and 5. In the Greco-Roman world, the head of the household was to command obedience from the others. But Paul appears to all members of the household as moral agents working out their mutual submission to one another. Let me quote a booklet here. The submission of wives in verse 21 is closely linked to the idea of the husband as head in verse 23, and there's no reference to origins here, as we talked about earlier. However, some scholars say that this is a commentary on Genesis chapter 2, and from verse 25, the focus is on the husband going ahead and taking the initiative. Head here, therefore, means head servant, and refers to a sort of servant leadership, as seen from Luke chapter 22, verse 25 onwards. That's the passage where the Lord Jesus Christ says, "The greatest leaders among you are those who serve." Therefore, and I quote, "If the code is set in the context of mutual submission, and if Christ is given as the example of loving self-sacrifice, then it cannot be said that this code simply repristinizes, that means reclaims in a pure form, the existing patriarchal order of things with gender-specific subordination of the female. Clearly, the loving self-sacrifice of the husband is depicted as the same sort of subordination." That's a quote from Witherington's book, The Letters to Philemon, the Colossians and the Ephesians, page 314. 1 Timothy 2, 8-15, "A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I'm not permitting a woman to teach or to usurp authority over a man. She must be in quietness. For Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not the one deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner. But she will be saved through the childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with propriety." And this one's often the clincher, really, on the role of women and how it relates to ministry in church life. Almost every part of this passage has been disputed by good Christians. There are several important things to note. Commentators generally agree that this letter is addressing a crisis. You have that sense in the letter. Something has gone wrong and the Apostle Paul wants to put it right. There has been false teaching, didaskalo, that's better than false doctrine. False teaching has crept in, and this is Paul's concern. And therefore, the second thing to note is the focus through the letter seems to be corrective rather than didactic, putting something right that's gone wrong, rather than laying out Paul's essential beliefs and concerns as he does in Romans. You can read more about that point in Linda Bell Veal's book, Teaching and Usurping Authority. So there's a general appreciation that something needs correcting, and that is what is shaping the argument here. Another thing of note through these chapters is Paul's repeated concern that the Christians in Ephesus live quiet and peaceable lives. There it is in chapter 2, verse 2, that we may live peaceful and quiet lives. This concern not to have disputes appears three times in the letter. First of all, to everyone, then in verse 8, there to men, and then finally in verse 12, to women. Learning in silence and in full submission. There are three Greek words for silent. One is in 1 Corinthians 14, which means to stop speaking. That's also in Luke 9:36. There's another word that is closely linked in its meaning to that, but there's a slight difference. The word here is none of those. It's hesuchios. Its root meaning doesn't mean says nothing. It's used in Acts 11:18 and Acts 21:14, and it's immediately followed by people saying something. It's best translated quiet down, cease your objections. It's used in 1 Thessalonians 4:11 and 2 Thessalonians 3:12. So you have disturbance on the one side. The word here is emphasizing the need to live a quiet life on the other, and it's within the community or in relation to the authorities. The command here for women mirrors the same to men, to be without argument, and is part of the wider concern to put an end to disruptions in worship. As with Ephesians 5, submission comes from the same root as hupotasso and should be distinguished from the idea of obedience, which is a different word. We mentioned that earlier. And the command is to be in submission to the teaching. Ian Paul makes the case that men are not mentioned here in relation to submission, which he says is striking because Paul is encouraging the women to learn, something that early traditions in the culture around that time discouraged and prohibited. I am not permitting is different from they must not, or even it is not permitted to, which is a phrase he could have used and he did in 1 Corinthians 14:34. Again, perhaps indicating that this command is limited to this particular situation going on at the time. Now, to be fair, Paul does use a similar construction of sentence elsewhere for general commands. And you'll find that in 1 Corinthians 7:10 and 1 Thessalonians 4:1 and 5:14. But the use of this particular verb always relates to specific situations in the New Testament. Therefore, one of my books argues it is perhaps more likely that Paul is signaling a new command which breaks with practice previously or elsewhere. After all, older women are to be good teachers in Titus 2:3, and we have seen that elsewhere in the Pauline corpus, women have some form of a teaching role. There's no grounds here for distinguishing between teaching in public and private contexts, not least because the social context of first century gatherings of believers does not allow for such distinction. What about usurping authority? This word authentine, similarly linked to authenteo, has been fiercely debated because a lot hangs on this. Now, it's a fairly neutral word, which means to have authority. But does that mean then that the verse can be read as a general, universal prohibition on women exercising authority over others? Or, and especially in the light of other verses we've been looking at, might it here have a negative sense about it for a particular reason, in which case the verse is prohibiting a special misuse of authority? As far as I'm aware, it's the only place this word occurs in the New Testament, which in itself is important because Paul uses other words for authority quite regularly in the Bible, but for this specific cause he chooses a slightly different word. And we find in other bodies of work from the time when this verb is used, it's almost always in a negative sense linked to getting one's own way, domineering, or to murder. I would encourage you to get the booklet Women and Authority for quite a few pages worth of discussion on the word there as a noun and as a verb. But drawing from a few authors who have studied this word, a comparison can be made like this. A father talks to his children or child and says, "You are not allowed to shout in such a way as to make a scene in public." In the same way, as a paraphrase of 1 Timothy 2:12, it would work like this. I am not permitting women to teach in such a way as to misuse authority in a domineering way over men. So the usurping authority phrase explains the way in which, in this situation, Paul is not allowing women to teach. The debate rages, do you select the neutral translation of the phrase or the negative? If it's the negative, then you have a warning against the misuse of authority by women. That's very different from using the term neutrally in a way to conclude that women must not have authority over men. Regarding the appeal to the creation order here, I'm just going to read from a booklet of mine. The main argument for a traditional reading of the text is that Paul appears to ground his argument in the creation order in chapter 2:13, suggesting that Adam had authority over Eve. But we have seen that authority plays no part in that text from Genesis 2. Rather than offering a cause, it is more likely we have here an explanation. This explanation suggests a corrective both to myths about Artemis, so that's the context at the time of the letter, who in ancient cosmology was created first and only subsequently took a male consort, and possible misunderstandings of Paul's own teaching. Don't forget, in Romans 5:14 and 1 Corinthians 5:22, Adam is said to be the origin of sin. Misreading this as Adam the first male, rather than Adam the first human being, might suggest that women had no part in sin, which Paul corrects here by noting that the woman was deceived. Elsewhere in 2 Corinthians 11 verse 2, Eve's deception becomes an example of what is possible for both men and women. The point here is not that women are more sinful than men, but that they are no less sinful than men. Understood as such a corrective, the idea fits with the sense of mutuality of origins set out in 1 Corinthians 11 verse 12, which also has a preceding corrective in a context where spiritual women appear to have wanted to dispense with marital and sexual relations, 1 Corinthians 7 onwards. Saved through childbirth, a number of us think that is a bad English translation because childbirth has a definite article in it. It is saved through the childbirth and is a reference to the salvation we have through the fact that Mary gave birth to the Messiah. If that's not your understanding, another popular understanding is women who just sort of keep their heads down and stay out of trouble, obviously whilst trusting in the Lord, which Paul emphasizes elsewhere, justification by faith, is the way to be, rather than disruptive and troublesome and always quarreling. So it's worth remembering that the Temple of Artemis in Ephesus was not only a wonder of the ancient world, but had huge impact on social life and commercial life there in Ephesus and the wider region of Asia. You can read about that in Acts chapter 19. So there may well have been thoughts that are being addressed here from women, that they are more spiritual than men and that they no longer had any need of men. There may well have been serious danger of women assuming leadership and authority without adequate education or the right spirit. Therefore, a picture emerges that here we have a corrective text. Far from suggesting hierarchical order of men over women, it's seeking to restore equal partnership in the face of arguments for the hierarchical ordering of women over men. Well, that was a long one. I'll sum it up for you. So if you've skipped it all, you've come to the conclusion, something like this. The gospel accounts have no embarrassment about the commissioning of women to roles that would normally be restricted to men, i.e. witnessing to the resurrection and communicating that gospel to many people. You may argue that there's no reference at all to institutional church life and roles. Okay, but if nothing else, the mere presence of those events and the recording of them in a positive light was utterly different from the culture at the time. Then you have evidence from Acts and Paul's writings that goes further than that. Women seem to occupy the roles of deacons, leaders, teachers, church planters, and even apostles. There doesn't seem to be any uniform limitation of certain roles or positions along gender-defined lines. I've sought to argue, using mainly Ian Paul's booklet, that the critical texts in 1 Corinthians, Ephesians, and 1 Timothy are best understood as offering a corrective in particular contexts, with the writers seeking to re-establish mutual interdependence, which was being lost, often in response to suggestions that women were superior or should be entirely independent from men. It seems to be a hard-pressed case to suggest that there is evidence in the Bible putting a permanent prohibition on women exercising authority or a teaching role on the grounds of their gender. I'm not convinced that this opens the door to let anything in and get the Bible to say what you want. I don't think that would be a fair assessment of what I've just been doing. You have to take each case on its own merits, and does it stack up with biblical exegesis? So just to tie it off, we'll do a little Q&A. The main questions are, well, why isn't this common in church history? Some of my historians friends would answer like this: the Dominicans, the Franciscans, the Cistercians, and other holy orders that made up the majority of preachers in the high Middle Ages were often majority female. Before that point, there were ordained ministries exclusively for women, such as deaconesses and consecrated virgins and consecrated widows. You also have in Saint Eusebius many references to the order of prophetesses, who look back to Philip's daughters. They were hugely influential in early Asia Minor and the Persian Empire. You had abbesses, I think that's how you say it, who were basically the boots on the grounds for some of the male bishops, and they would carry out communion and other roles, so the lines were often blurred between bishop and abbess. In the early church, though bishops were almost exclusively men, you had women carrying out real authoritative roles. You now have women bishops in modern times, and the matter is more about, is it biblical rather than has it featured much in church history before? Why is it that Paul seems to talk about an elder should have one wife and doesn't seem to address wives? Well, there's lots of reasons for the primacy of male leadership that I've touched on in the video. Whether that's entirely theological, I'm not that convinced, as I tried to lay out in the larger video. There may be cultural reasons for that. I think it's also important that the role of a judge is also addressed to men only in Exodus chapter 18, but Deborah gets on fine doing that role. The modern Protestant tradition certainly hasn't allowed many women preachers and elders until recent times, and so it's important to remember that the early female preachers were connected mainly with monasteries, and with the dissolution of monasteries came the end, really, of women preachers. Maybe it just sort of happened rather than there was robust biblical reasons for it too. Of course, many people open their Bible and think that there are reasons from the Bible as to why it stopped. Fine, just watch the video and make of it what you will. The Anabaptists allowed female preachers, but they were a bit strange. Perhaps didn't do the reputation of it all that well. As so have the Methodists and the Salvation Army. So there we are. Food for thought, at least.